Okay, the subject of this next part of the Dhamma Enrichment Camp for the Modern Age is the busy person's method of easy meditation. But I'll just get people started. I'll just answer these two questions first of all, because they probably came from the last session. Dear Ajahn Brahm, thank you for your answer. I haven't given it yet. Isn't that wonderful gratitude? They thank me no matter what I answer. How can a business owner be successful in their business without being pushy or a hard sell, even though they are looking for success and confidence? I find it tiring to constantly worrying about new business. How can I be more at peace knowing business will come in? Is it possible to be Buddhist in my business practice without being desperate? Yeah, of course it is. I am the CEO of a big monk factory in Perth. I've got the franchise for Theravada Buddhism in Western Australia, and I've expanded my franchise to many other outlets throughout the world. So I'm a big businessman. I'm in the monk business. But you don't need to be pushy or hard sell. If you've got a good product, then people will come to you. And that's my sort of motto. Develop your product. And then usually word of mouth will get around. And you'll be very successful. And many executives actually tell me that the secret of business success is actually their contacts. Being able to work with other people, make those contacts, being kind, being trustworthy, and getting on with people. It's those contacts and networking, that's what really brings you success in business. Now, when you need a product, when you need to sell it somewhere, getting those contacts, those people you know, and that's how you get success in business. And if you're pushy, what happens when you push someone? You push them off. In other words, you're not friends anymore. Anyone who's pushy, you shouldn't be pushy, you should be bringy, not pushy. Bring people towards you. In other words, sort of attract people, be kind, be nice. And then, actually, people come to you. So you don't need to be pushy. And modern business practice is to know the most important part of your company actually is not your product, it's the people. The most important part of a business is the people who work for you. And if you really value your major asset, which is people, and this is not just Buddhism, this is what I was hearing in London, this big HR conference, PricewaterhouseCoopers, British Airways, who else was there? Heaps of other big companies, I forget now. And they were all saying the same thing. Or that the people, this is what we really value. And if you cultivate the people, cultivate, you know, the people working for you and your business contacts, then your business will get very, very successful. Because that is your main asset. You know, people, we've got plenty of products and people need things in this world. It's actually getting these products out. And the only way you can do that is through people. So if you value the people in your business, in your company, your business will go very, very well. In other words, be a good Buddhist. And if you're a good Buddhist, your Buddhist business is going up and up and up. So I think we should have a stock market just for Buddhist businesses. No, the so what is the stock market in Malaysia called? Okay, can we start the Buddhist stock market, the Buddhist index, the Buddhist bourse company, the BBC? Because that only Buddhist stocks, and we know because of the Buddhist stocks, they'll go up, 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 up. They'll rise all the way to Nirvana. Yes, it might do too. But anyway, no, that modern business people, there's a lot of big business people actually becoming Buddhists. There's one person I know, his name is John Akehurst. He was the CEO of Woodside Petroleum. Woodside is one of the big mining companies, got huge amounts of energy, oil and gas leases over in the northwest shelf of Western Australia, exporting billions of dollars of, you know, liquefied gas over to China and other countries. And this CEO of this big company, you know, he wrote this article that he found there was problems up in the boardroom. And he found out what the problem was him. He called himself a pain in the ass. I'm just quoting him. And he said that he decided to do something about it. You know what he did? He learnt meditation and became a Buddhist. And now he's resigned from actually Woodside. He's now a big gas company, Alintegas, one of the big energy providers of Western Australia. So these are big CEOs who are learning some Dhamma, practicing meditation because it works. And they can get a much better business and become more successful. So the modern trend in the West is for CEOs to meditate and become Buddhists. So here in Malaysia, you are ahead of the game. You go first and the West follows. So it's actually, you can be a good business owner, and but don't be too pushy. You've got to be strong, assertive, but don't forget the personal values and contacts you have with your friends and colleagues and business associates. That networking you find is the most important for business success. Next question. If we have enough of virtue, will all bad people and spirits stay away from us? Now, when you have lots and lots of virtue, should I say this? All the ghosts come to you to get your merits. I don't want to be good anymore, some people. No, because when you actually, the truth of the matter is, when you are virtuous, the bad people, bad spirits, they can't come close. This is one of the stories I tell. There was a Thai girl many years ago in our monastery in Perth. Very good Thai Buddhist, one of the chief supporters, would always be there to help, always bringing food for the monks. And she had one, her father had died, had a mother left over in Thailand. And she thought, mother's alone. You know, it's not right, you know, filial piety, to have my mother living in Thailand while I'm living in Australia. So she got her mother a visa, paid an air ticket, and brought her mother over to stay with her and her children. So her mother was staying, elderly mother, staying in Perth for many years. But eventually she got sick. Now she was an old lady. And this girl, her name was Ratana, this girl Ratana thought, I wonder if my mother's going to survive this illness. And she wanted to know. So she went to a medium, one of these spirit doctors in Perth, and said, look, I want to know where my mother's going to survive this current illness she has. She's in hospital right now. So the medium said, sure, I can find that out for you. It costs $20, $20. So she gave her the $20, and this medium went into a trance. Oh, first of all, she had to know what hospital, what ward, and what room, because you're going to leave her body and check out this old lady. So they gave her the name of the hospital, the ward number, the room number, and this spirit doctor went into a trance for about 20 minutes. And when she came out of the trance afterwards, she gave the $20 back to this Thai girl. She said, why are you giving it back? He said, look, I tried. I found the hospital, I found the ward, I found the room, but I just could not get into the room. He said, your mother was strange, I'd never seen this before. She had a force field around it, her, and I just could not penetrate it to find out whether she was going to survive this illness or not. That's why I couldn't do it, so I'm giving you $20 back. But by the way, I never seen anything like that. Who is your mother anyway? And this girl, this Thai girl, said, oh, my mother's a Buddhist nun. She's been like a mayor chief for the last 25 years. And the medium took the $20 back. You should have told me beforehand. People like me can't get close to people like that. And that was a true story of like a medium, a spirit doctor who actually left the body like a ghost will do, like a spirit could do, but could not get close to a person of such strong virtue. And what was interesting is the way she felt when she tried to approach this old Thai Buddhist nun was a force field protecting her around. And that's actually what spirits will feel. If you're a very, very good, kind person, they feel that force field and they won't be able to come in without your permission. You can keep them out if you want to. But if you've got compassion, you say, come in, it's all right, come on. And you can share some of your goodness with them. But the point is that you have a bit more control when you've got goodness and kindness. And also bad people. Bad people and evil people, they just can't get close to you. I remember this other fellow. He's from Singapore. And I blessed him with some holy water that day, and I gave him the precepts. And he went to a party that night. He didn't drink alcohol, but when he went to the party, there was this man, I think another Chinese man, he was into black magic. You know, like black magic, and it's a very bad thing to get into. But as soon as this man, Victor his name was, not Victor Wee, another Victor, as soon as this Victor came into the room, this black magician got really tense and looked at him and said, "I've got to get out. I can't stay in the same room with someone like you." Simply because he had been blessed that very day. And that had actually protected him. And this black magician, who was obviously into some very bad practices, just could not stay even in the same room. And those are two examples I have had from my own experience, that when you do keep precepts, you are very, very strong and very protected. So that's what actually happens. So if you keep precepts, you've got no worries at all. You are much stronger than other people. Maybe the other story, which is a funny story, that I was staying with my mother, looking after her a few years ago, and it came the time when it was time for my lunch. My mother was cooking lunch. So I was just staying in the room, looking after some things. And there was a knock on the door of my mother's apartment. So I thought, "Mum, you carry on cooking, because that's more important." Because I like my mother's cooking. I'll answer the door. So I went to the door, my monk's robes. And when I answered the door, there was a lady on the other side, and she said that she was a gypsy, and she was selling gypsy trinkets. "Do you want to buy like a piece of heather?" And I was very polite. I said, "No, thank you." I was about to go, and she said, "If you don't buy this, I will put a gypsy curse on you." That was their marketing trick. And I stood up and I said, "Can you not see? I am a Buddhist monk. My curses are much stronger than yours." I was being cheeky. And this poor lady, her face went white. She turned around, she ran away. I know I shouldn't have done that, but it was good fun. Of course, there's no such thing as Buddhist curses, but she didn't know that. No, it wasn't. It was just skillful means. But it was true that, that bad people, they can't handle like Buddhist monks and nuns, because we've got far too much power, and we're just not scared of things. That's why they can't do anything. Anyway, the busy person's method of meditation. Now, as Buddhists, everybody likes to meditate, but sometimes they just can't find the time. Or if they do find the time, they go thinking about all the sorts of stuff they shouldn't think of. Or if they stop their thinking, they fall asleep, and they think, "Oh, it's just so hard to meditate. How can ever I meditate?" And so a lot of times people give up and they don't even try to meditate. And that way they miss out one of the beautiful, wonderful assets of Buddhism, the skillful ways of meditating and bringing peace and happiness and relaxation to your body and mind. Not only is it a very, very pleasant thing to be able to do, but it's also so good for your health and well-being, even for your marriages and for your families. Even a couple of days ago when I was teaching in Perth, I told this story that many years ago when I taught at that group, a woman came after the meditation session and confessed that she never wanted to come to meditation that evening. She'd just come home from work, a very busy day. She was so tired she had to make the dinner for her husband and kids. She just wanted just to sit down and relax. But her children said, "Mummy, are you going to meditation?" "No, I don't feel like it. I'm tired." "Mummy, you should go to meditation." "No, I don't want to go." "Mummy, go to meditation." "Why?" said Mummy to her kids. "Because you're a much nicer mummy when you come back from meditation." When I told that sort of last Tuesday, this lady came up afterwards and said, "Look, absolutely true. That happened to me that evening. I never wanted to come to meditation. My kids said, "Mummy, go." Because it's true, the kids know you're a much nicer mummy and a much nicer daddy once you've been to meditation. And so it's really important for you, and it's wonderful to be able to do that. It's better for your kids, for your husband, for your wife, for everybody when you learn that. Not good for your mistress. No, it doesn't work for that, because it makes you really guilty, and so you should be. But it's very, very good for your health, emotional, and everything else, which is why it's just so popular over in the West. But sometimes the busy people, they meditate busily, and that's not meditation. So busy people have to understand what busyness is, and when they're sitting down with their eyes closed, stop being busy, but learn how to really relax. And this experience happened just last October, because I was in a conference, a meditation conference over in Sydney, and this professor from Stanford, he'd been investigating meditation, because there's huge numbers of courses now in Oxford, in Stanford, in Princeton, in Harvard, where you can actually study meditation. You can get a PhD in it, a doctor of samadhi. You can. And there's so much research being done these days. And he was telling me that they did this experiment, all paid for by the university. They got two groups of students, split them in half. They had to have the control group as well as the meditators. So they had people meditating for a whole day, while the other group, as a control, they sent them at the university's expense to a resort to spend the day in a spa by the pool, relaxing. It's not bad, isn't it, being paid just to relax? But he wanted to find out afterwards, with doing things like MRI scans and sort of questionnaires, which group relaxed the most, the people meditating or the people who went to the spa. And it was very, very clear that afterwards, the people who went to the spa were far more relaxed. Very embarrassing. But the reason was the sort of meditation they were doing. And many of you have known different types of meditation. It's a very fierce meditation, a very strict meditation, which you do get more tense afterwards. Now, that's not the meditation for busy people. So if you're a busy person, you don't want to do a meditation which makes you even more stressed out than when you began. Otherwise, it's much better you go to spa instead. That's why that every year, I think we've got some brochures out, every year that the group in Singapore have organized, they call it executive retreat. They do that because it's aimed at very busy people. And we do it in a resort in Khao Lak in Thailand. We did it last year as an experiment. Not 8 precepts, 5 precepts. That's enough for you guys. You're not monks or nuns. 5 precepts is good enough if you can actually give up your alcohol or your wine and other things and tell the truth. If every Buddhist kept 5 precepts, oh, my life would be much easier. So it's a 5-precept retreat. If people want to keep 8 precepts, they can do a bit extra. But also you have what we call Nobel silence in these retreats. You know what Nobel silence means? No bells. That's right, no bell silence. Because that's the last thing you want in a retreat when you're trying to relax. Have a bell, get up bell, a bell to sit down again, a bell to go to lunch, a bell to finish lunch. Gee, just like being in prison again or at school. So there's no bells. So people can get up whenever they want. And they can, yeah, it's true. You can just go and have a breakfast. Not sort of like lunch boxes, but, you know, big spread or whatever you want. And then afterwards, a little bit of a talk, a little bit of a meditation. And then have lunch. Go and walk by the beach, swim in the pool. Swimming meditation, we call it. Then afterwards, a bit more meditation, a talk. Have your evening dinner. Come back again. more meditation, a little bit of a talk. You can see how gentle that is. And many people who've never meditated for the first time think, wow, this is great, I don't need to feel afraid. Because many people are like that. They hear meditation, they think meditation is getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning, only eating 2 meals a day, sleeping next to someone who snores all night, and having to deal with achy arms, achy legs, achy backs, and just having pain, and also having to pay for that as well. And sometimes you think, is that really the best way of introducing modern people to meditation? A few people will do that. Now these are usually the young ones who have got fit and healthy, got a bit of time and got some energy. But for many people who do that type of meditation, we have to get up early and everything is structured and it's very, very austere. Many people like that, they just will not go because they're afraid of the physical discomfort. So making it a little bit soft and easy gets people in the first time. And it also, the most important thing, is it teaches people the importance of relaxation if you're going to meditate. And how to be calm and peaceful, relax the body first, and then you might be able to relax your mind. But bodily relaxation comes first. When the body's at ease, then the mind can be still. Now what actually happened in the last retreat, and what will certainly happen this time as well, you tell me you don't have to get up until 7 o'clock and just get out of bed for breakfast, or get room service if you want to. And you can come in for a little bit of meditation here, a little bit of meditation there. Because there's no pressure on people, a lot of people really relax and for the first time they understand what meditation is all about. They get some peace in their meditation. And then what happens next is, because they're enjoying it, they want a bit more. So they get up earlier and they come completely voluntarily before breakfast to the meditation. And they stay there longer, not because they're forced to, but because they like to. And little by little, many people say, what do I want to eat for in the afternoon? I'm just having too much of a time, maybe have a cup of tea like the monks. They're not forced to keep 8 precepts, they do it because they want to. And this takes all the force and the pressure off the meditation, and it becomes this wonderful natural progress into more and more peace and stillness. So understanding the psychology of the mind, when you make it easy, people don't become lazy. They start to rise up to a very, very wonderful meditation schedule without any force imposed upon them at all. So they get the peace, they put in the hours without any stress. And this is the most important part of meditation, especially for busy people. Because you're busy, you have enough stress already. You're working hard, and you struggle just to get through the day, and you go on a retreat, and if it's a struggle again, wow, you're never going to go again on a meditation retreat. That's why in most meditation retreats, many of you have been on retreats before, when do they take the group photograph on a retreat? At the end. You know why they take the group photograph at the end? Because that's the only time when people are smiling and happy, because they're about to go home. If you took the photograph in the middle of the retreat, then you could actually see what people are up to, grimacing. So it's important to learn that meditation is the art of peace and happiness. And when you know that's what the purpose of meditation is, then you understand why it's so important for busy people. Because it's teaching you how to relax. How to get a bit of peace and ease in your body and in your mind. Busy people are the ones who need to know how to relax the most. Because you're working your body so hard, you need to be very efficient in the short time you have to really relax and become at peace. If you know how to do that, it's amazing what you can do to relax the body and to relax the mind. So recently, you know, for such busy people, if you just tell them just to go and watch the breath, they just can't do it. They either look at their breath with force as if they're trying to work out a contract. Come on, apply yourself. Or they start watching it, and because they're so tired, they completely fall asleep. There's a trouble. There's the two big problems for busy people, the wandering mind or the sort of the dull mind. And it's of those two, the wandering mind is much worse. At least if you're dull, you're getting a bit of rest. Maybe you're not there to enjoy it, but at least, you know, your brain is shutting down for a bit. But the wandering mind, those people who think, they're the biggest problem. And I think that's probably you. Can't stop thinking. Can't stop worrying. Can't stop. And when you look, think of, you know, you contemplate what you're thinking about, it's completely nonsense. Most of the stuff you think about, you know, if you could actually, if I could get sort of a tape recorder and put it to your head and record all the thoughts which you'd had in the last hour and play that back, you'd be so embarrassed. Complete nonsense is what we think about. So we're really not using our mind properly. So the meditation which I've been teaching to execs and found it very, very effective is a very gentle sweeping meditation to get you aware of your physical feelings first of all, but not noting them. Because I noticed the reason I told this professor in Stanford, the reason that the people you taught meditation to were more stressed out than the people who went to the spa was because you did mindfulness, but you missed the important ingredient of kindness. And this is why that when you do any type of mindfulness meditation, please add that magic ingredient of kindness and compassion. Because it's the kindness and compassion which relaxes you. So the meditation I've been teaching, not doing it yet, I'm just adjusting myself because I'm a bit tight in here. The meditation which I teach for executives, for busy people, is a very quick body sweep. I usually ask them, close your eyes, relax the body, and start with your toes. Ask them, can you feel any sensations in your toes right now? Now, a lot of people are completely oblivious to any feelings in the toes, but when you look, you can actually feel something down there. Any sensation will do. When you're mindful of any sensation, I call that contact. The mind is contacting that part of the body. Once you have a line of communication between your brain and your toe, the next thing to do is to send kindness, metta, compassion along that channel of communication. May my toes be happy and well. You relax your toes. Now, every human being knows the process of bodily relaxation. You feel things opening, expanding, soothing, becoming easy and loose. Tightness, knots, the knots untied, the tightness expands. You feel this wonderful sense of expansive comfort in your toes. You're relaxing a part of the body. And I start from the toes and work up through the feet, through the ankles, through the calves, through the knees, through the thighs, to the bottom. Little by little you can pick up sensations there, but it's not just being mindful, it's being kind to that area of the body. You know why people relax in the spa or when they're being massaged? It's because when you say being massaged, you feel your attention is drawn to that part of the body and someone is being kind to you. They're caring enough to spend some time massaging that part of the body. That is why you relax. You have feeling, softness, kindness, and that relaxes all of those muscles. So as you actually go through the body, from the toes upwards, by the time you get to your bottom, notice the feelings there and just relax them, you actually become quite skilled in knowing how to relax. The mechanism is very well known to explain it, you're mindful of it, and when you're kind to it, wish it well, the feeling changes, it becomes more easy, more comfortable, you know you've relaxed a little bit, you carry on with that type of intention, a very kind, soft intention, and you relax a bit more. Because the mindfulness not only tells you what's going on now, but tells you what changes, you get feedback. And that feedback shows you whether you're going in the correct direction or not. If it is the correct direction, you're getting more ease, more peace, more relaxation. It feels more delightful as the pains disappear. And by the time you've gone through your legs, the legs are not so important as far as your physical health is concerned. And also, you don't have many sensations down. And by the time you get to your bottom and you start working up your torso, this is a place where many of the diseases and the tensions and the sicknesses lie. You start working up. You may have trouble with your digestion. And by the time you get to, say, you know, your waist, you can look inside there and you can feel sensations in your colon. Can you feel sensations in your colon now? In the lower part of your digestive tract? Send those feelings kindness, compassion, relax them, expand them, loosen the knots. You soon learn from mindfulness and kindness to relax parts of the body you've hardly ever paid attention to. You can feel tightness, tension, irritations getting less and less and less. One of the biggest problems, one of the problems, diseases people have these days is called irritable bowel syndrome. I don't know if there's anyone here who has irritable bowel syndrome. This is an effective way of helping. Notice that sensation with your mindfulness and just be kind, compassionate towards it. Still remember as a kid, growing up in the poor streets of London, because again my parents weren't wealthy at all, just in a government subsidized apartment, I used to spend most of my day playing soccer in the street. And when you went for a tackle, if you're doing it on the grass, you know, you don't injure yourself. We went for a tackle and you scrape your skin on the sort of the tarmac road. I was always rushing to my mother with my knees grazed and bleeding. You know what my mother would do? She would kiss it better. She would put her lips with all those germs and bacteria on my open wound. I never knew that at the time. And kiss it, and the pain went away, and I rushed off and played soccer again. Never got infected. Why? Simply because my mother was being kind to me. And that's all I really needed, a bit of attention and kindness. The pain disappeared and healing happened. That works. If you have mindfulness and compassion, that's a very powerful combination. So you put it to your irritable bowel, you notice the feelings and just soothe them, expand them, ease them. Mindfulness and metta together. And everything gets so soft. And you feel a lot better. And you go right through the body, up through the whole torso. If there's any part of the body you've got a problem with, a kidney, lung, heart, back, stop there and relax it. What you're learning to do with mindfulness and compassion, you're learning how to relax every part of your body. Instead of just saying, "I relax," you're relaxing incrementally, stage by stage, and you find you become very skilled in your bodily relaxation. You can relax your arms next, and I actually go to the head last of all. Now relax all the muscles in my face. And feel the sensations, just be kind, and every muscle starts to get soft and easy. And last of all, I go to 2 or 3 inches behind my eyes where my brain is. And I don't know whether I'm just imagining the feeling of the brain or it's actually real, but it doesn't matter. I imagine a feeling or pick up a feeling centered around the brain area, and I send my brain compassion. I have to use my brain so much these days. There, poor brain. Take it easy, relax, have a nice time. You actually, and your brain feels nicer. It feels relaxed. You stop thinking and worrying so much because you're relaxing your brain. There, brain, you're okay. Now with that degree of mindfulness and compassion, you learn how to relax your whole body. Now because you're relaxing your body, you actually feel good. You have a a payback straight away of physical comfort, less irritation, less aches, less pains. So busy people like that because it does feel better than going to a spa. And also, it's much cheaper. These spas and resorts are very expensive, and you can do much better with just a very simple relaxation technique. And you teach that to busy executives to learn them how to relax their body. But it's not just their body you're relaxing. It's almost like a trick, a skillful means, because when they're relaxing their body, when they're aware of physical feelings and sending compassion and kindness, it's a combination of mindfulness meditation and loving kindness meditation. And they're in the present moment because the feelings are always located in the now. And you know, you don't really plan what feeling you're going to have tomorrow. You may plan where you're going to go to get that feeling, but you don't actually plan, yeah, tomorrow I must remember to sort of be happy. It's in the moment, especially physical feelings. And so it centers you in the moment. And it's an interesting and fascinating thing to do, so you don't tend to think so much while you're going through the body. All of the stuff you usually think about is just disappears. So you're actually calming your mind at the same time you're doing this relaxation technique. So usually what happens, as soon as a person finishes sweeping their body and relaxing it as they go along, I usually say, okay, now how does your body feel? Oh, it feels so nice. They're enjoying their meditation. Well done, you're getting going. The next thing is just watch your breath. Because they've been watching the feelings of the body, it's very easy to watch the feeling of the breath. It's just another bodily feeling, that's all. But the most important thing, I said, now give your breath kindness and relax it. And they just spent maybe 20 minutes relaxing their body, and it's very easy to use that same mechanism to transfer the same mental intentions which produce relaxation in the body to produce relaxation in the breath. And the breath gets so soft and easy. And you don't want to go anywhere because you're relaxing the breath. And as every doctor will know, if you relax the breath, the mind relaxes as well. And you're starting to emphasize the important part of meditation is bodily and mental relaxation. And that makes it very clear, you're not supposed to be tense and tightening the mind, I've got to watch the breath, or I've got to be, I must be mindful. That's not the way meditation works. You're relaxing, giving ease, comfort, peace, soothing. That's what meditation is. And once you really relax like this, the body's relaxed and you relax the breath, it is so easy to meditate. And people have never meditated before. They get into this and say, wow, this is really nice. I feel so good. Because you need to get some feedback. You need to get something out of meditation. Otherwise you won't want to do it anymore. And you feel physically good, mentally good. And also, everybody these days is so concerned about their health, they eat all sorts of health foods. In fact, they eat so many health foods, they worry so much about their health, that's what makes them sick. It's not the food they eat, it's the worrying about it. That's what causes them sickness. So those people who are concerned about their health, you know that this little technique, learning how to relax and soothe and ease, that's powerful, it's good for your health. And so people will not begrudge spending time for their health. Even executives go to the gym. They can find time for that. Why? Because it's important for their health. So by emphasizing the health benefits of this type of meditation, you're getting more busy people involved. Because they know that they've got to keep fit and healthy, otherwise they will never be able to carry on their business. If you get sick and have to be in hospital for a couple of weeks, that's very difficult if you're running a business. You can't afford to be sick. Which is why you can learn how to be healthy. But it's not just health foods. It's learning how to relax the body and relax the mind. Which is why executives value this type of meditation. They feel it's good for their health. And this has been incredibly popular with people with cancers. Had the Melanoma Foundation not the Millennium, the Breast Cancer Foundation, West Australia, came, and I taught them meditation. They loved it. They said, can we get a tape of it? I haven't got the tape yet, but one of these days I'll get around to doing it. I'm a lazy monk, as I said this morning. Because I say, if people with breast cancer, you should stop at your breasts. You can feel sensations there. And just relax everything. Send it calmness, kindness. You've gone through the whole body. By the time you get to this point, you should be quite mindful, alert, and able to spend an enormous amount of relaxing energy to that part of the body. And people feel it, just soothing and relaxing. Most cancers are the sign of stress. But you're looking at that part of the body where the injury is, and de-stressing the whole area. And you do start to feel, oh, that's really nice. It feels good, it feels relaxed. And of course that's having a huge positive impact on the tumor. Shrinking it, easing it, because that's exactly what you've been doing. So when you say these things, people get really interested. I notice all the women are really listening now. Because it's frightening, the incidence of breast cancer in our modern world. If you haven't got it yet, you know, you've got a decent chance of getting it. That's why people say, wow, this is important. And that way, we're making the meditation really value. People want to do it because they need to do it. And it's not just helping your physical health, it's actually the trick. It's using physical health in order to turn you onto the path of mental health, of relaxing the mind and relaxing the body. Because it's not that hard. Once you know how to relax the body, you relax the breath, it's not that hard, again, to take the same mechanism and learn how to relax the mind, to soothe it, to ease it. You notice the sensations of mind. Now the tiredness, the worry, the anxiety, and relax. Send kindness to your own mind. It doesn't matter if you've been thinking stupid thoughts. It doesn't matter if you've been worrying when you're not supposed to. Be kind. And with that kind attention, mindfulness plus compassion, everything relaxes. And you find you've got an amazing technique of meditation. You can call it Anapanasati if you want, mindfulness meditation if you want, insight. You don't care what you call it. It works. And you feel you're getting more and more relaxed. And when you get really relaxed, and you can do relaxation very quickly, when you come out of meditation afterwards, because you've relaxed, you're raring to go. You've got energy. You got clarity. And so the work which you have to do, you can do it easily. The reason why people get stressed out is because they have to work but they're not ready to work. You're forcing yourself. You're struggling just to get through. You know, other times, you know, you're really rested, relaxed, and you look at the work and it's easy to do. You're just raring to go. Unfortunately, we get so tired that life becomes a burden. We're just walking up this steep hill and we've got no place to sit down and relax. But you have got a place to relax if you know how to do this meditation, you value it. And sometimes people say, well, look, I haven't got time to do this. This one friend I know, he had a beautiful idea, and I really recommend it to everybody who works in an office. He decided to relax every hour on the hour for 1 minute. So when it came on the hour, say, you know, 9 o'clock in the morning, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, he'd be sitting at his desk, he'd close his eyes and meditate for 1 minute. When his boss came past, he said, oh, he must be thinking about the contract. He wasn't at all. He was just watching his breath and being mindful. Because no one knows what you're up to. Your boss can't read your mind. So when you're actually closing your eyes, no one knows what you're up to. So you can meditate without getting into any trouble whatsoever. And so he was meditating, taking a minute off every hour while he was at work. And he didn't mind doing that because he realized by just resting and centering himself every hour on the hour, he knew that that would make his mind relaxed enough so the next 59 minutes of work he could do so well. In fact, the minute he gave to meditation was more than made up by the extra productivity in the next 59. He got an hour and a quarter's work done in 59 minutes because he knew how to relax and energize his mind. And that's why we have to have meditation for busy people. The more busy you are, the more you need to know how to relax. Otherwise, we're going to get this stressed out population. You know, when I gave that talk at this conference in London, you were saying that £200 I charge for a talk. I don't charge £200, but what actually happened? Just before I was about to give my masterclass at this big conference, the organizer came up to me and said, there's a couple of people masquerading as your relations trying to get in for free. I said, my relations aren't, they haven't told me they were coming. So I said, I'll go and check them out. And I went outside, you know, accompanied by the organizer. It was my brother and my niece. They never told me they were coming. I could have done something. And they said, no. And I taught the organizer, look, I've come all the way from Australia. The least you can do is, you know, let my relations come in, you know, for free. And they said, well, look, we usually only allowed one guest per speaker. But, okay, come on. So I got my brother and my niece to come into my talk. And then I told my brother, I said, you know, you almost got me to trouble there, you cheapskate. Can't you afford to sort of pay a few pounds to get in? And that's when he told me, he said, you know how much they were going to charge just to come into my talk, each person, £200 for 1 hour talk. Now I know my market value. Level of compassion. I was really stunned that people have charged £200. How many ringgit is that? 1,400 ringgit for 1 hour. How many hours am I here today? What's it? No, but that's not what we do. But at that particular, after I came back from that talk, I got an email from the British National Health Service because they wanted me to go back and teach a masterclass at their annual general conference in Birmingham. That was supposed to be last October, but I couldn't go because it was our arranged retreat time. And I was amazed. The British National Health Service wanted to get a Buddhist monk. You know why? Because people in Britain are so sick, they need a monk to teach them how to be healthy. How to relax, how to be peaceful. And that was the sort of meditation I was teaching them. Just because when you let go of the stress of your busy life, and we're all getting busier and busier and busier, our workload is increasing. No, my workload is increasing. And the only way I cope is my meditation. I relax and enjoy myself. And that's why I do a busy schedule without really worrying about it or getting tense or stressed out. And that's why I am competent to teach busy people, because I'm a busy monk. This is how you do it. And it's good for your health, which is why the British National Health Service said, we want you to come to teach us how to be healthy. Too many busy people. You need to know how to relax. And when you know how to relax quickly, effectively, then your stress levels go way down and you can perform to a much higher level. You become more employable. You are able to take on tasks which other people aren't. And just like my market rate of £200 an hour, you maybe even exceed my market rate in your job. Because you can handle the stress, because you know how to relax when you get tired and keep on going. If you haven't heard this simile before, how heavy is the glass of water? This is an old simile, repeat it many times. How heavy is this glass of water? Actually, many of you have got bottles of water. Come on, hold your bottle of water up. How heavy is a bottle of water? Keep it at arm's length. Doesn't matter, you will notice, can you notice this? The longer you hold it, the heavier it feels. Keep on holding it until it feels quite heavy and your arm starts to ache. The longer you hold it, the heavier it feels. What should you do when it starts to hurt? Put it down. Put it down for a minute. Only a minute. Maybe less than that. Now pick it up again. Does it feel lighter?
Yes.
Exactly. It's the same amount of water. You can put it down now. Because you've rested, it's easier to carry. It actually feels lighter. Now this is actually the busyness, the burdens which you have to do in life. Stress has nothing to do with how much burdens and responsibilities you have. What stress is when it gets heavy, you don't know how to put it down. If you know how to put things down, you can pick it up again, it always feels lighter, your arm never aches or hurts. I think you've got the message here. If you know how to relax your body and mind, whether it's 1 minute, every hour, or whenever you need it, whenever your brain starts to hurt, when your mind gets tired, you start to get grumpy, put it down, rest for a few minutes. When you pick up that burden again, it will actually feel lighter, be easier to carry. So that's how you do it. And that's how we have meditation for busy people. It's not that hard to do, especially when you add this wonderful ingredient of kindness to your mindfulness, which gives you happiness. When you have happiness with the mindfulness and kindness, then you like meditating, you want to meditate, it's enjoyable, it's delightful, you feel benefits straight away, and think, oh, this is nice. And that's why you will meditate again and again and again. And you have this wonderful thing of peace of mind, and you don't need to be a monk or a nun to get that peace of mind. Anyone can, right now, by learning how to relax the body, relax the breath, and relax the mind. Relax to the max is my motto. So that, in brief, is how to meditate for busy people. So far we've done lazy people, busy people, and if you're waiting for your section, crazy people, that's coming after tea. But now is the time for questions about the meditation for busy people, an easy meditation. The reason I call it easy, because it makes you feel at ease, which is what Buddhist meditation is supposed to do. So, who's going to ask the first question? Any questions from upstairs? Again, get precedence. You know, I told them upstairs, they got much more delicious food upstairs than you did down here. Because heavenly realms, they've got more pleasure. So, you got a question? Yes.
I think, Ram, you mentioned that a busy person should take 1 minute every hour to meditate. So, in essence, does meditation involve only breathing, breathing out as a way of relaxing the mind? And this is what you should do every day, every hour, even if you are not busy. Am I right in understanding the concept you're trying to put across?
No. You're not that busy, so you should just maybe do 59 minutes every hour. Sorry. No, I think this was just a person who had a very demanding job. And he just could not walk away from his desk to do anything more than, 1 minute. And so he used this as a skillful means. It was an example of what can be done if you are wise enough. And so he knew he couldn't actually get out of the office and sit in the corner. People would bother him. But he did know that when you close your eyes, sitting exactly where you are, no one knows what you're doing. So that was his way of escaping, not away from his desk, but inside his body and in his mind, a place of refuge inside. Now he was very, very demanding job. For those people who haven't got such demanding jobs, you have more time. And you find that by being still, you make time. But I'm saying what you make time is like the 5 minutes you spend, say, in meditation, you get much more done more quickly afterwards. So maybe you're working for an hour afterwards. If you haven't had that break, an hour's work is not high quality, not very productive. If you've had the break, in 1 hour you get the equivalent of 2 hours normal work done. Have you ever noticed that, your efficiency and productivity? Now, I don't know why in business people don't look at that and the causes for increased productivity and efficiency. Instead, they say work more. If you work longer hours, you get more done. And sometimes it doesn't work that way. You just rest, take a break, and then you get more done. So it's not just hours of work, it's quality of your work. And when you get tired, please take a break. Otherwise, you know, you'll make mistakes. I'm sure that's what that guy in Société Générale did, who lost how much? $7 billion for that bank? Probably working too long in front of the computer until his brain stuffed up and made big mistakes. A whole bank can almost go down. Just one stupid person who gets stressed out and can't see what they're doing. So remember to relax and have a clear mind. Then you can be far more effective and efficient. But if you've got a demanding job, I know you haven't. So you've got no excuse for spending more than 1 minute every hour on the job. And one of the reasons, why do people not meditate? It's one of the questions I ask myself. Why is it that not more people meditate? And it's because they don't enjoy it. So if you know how to enjoy meditation, feel this beautiful relaxation, it feels so nice. And once people enjoy meditation, then they meditate more and more and more. And it's not something you go like going to the dentist. You know, thinking, oh, I've got to meditate today, I suppose I've got to do it. Get it out of the way as soon as possible. People do it and they love it. They enjoy it. Once you love and enjoy meditation, then they know you know how to meditate. Yes.
When it comes to meditation, right? If we just do like relaxation, and not, you know, apply any fancy techniques that we can read from books and all that, does the development of our meditation practice come naturally?
Yes. Great question. A simple answer. If you learn how to relax the body and relax the mind, does all the other effects of meditation happen naturally? They do. Meditation is a natural process. This is one of my favorite similes, and this is actually an original. I didn't get this from Ajahn Chah. You see this bottle of water here. Those in the front row, like Victor, I'm going to try and hold this bottle of water still. Is it still yet? Still, I'll try harder. I'll concentrate. Is it still yet, Jinchai? I'll try harder. Come on. I might practice this for all my life. I'll never be able to hold this still. It's the nature of muscles in the arm always to move. It's not that I've got Parkinson's disease. I know I'm a mover and shaker in Buddhism, but not that way. But there is a very simple way to get this water to be absolutely still. And all I need to do is to put it down. When I first put it down, it moves more. It's the nature of water to do that. But all I need to do is to leave it alone, to let it go, to relax. Because I feel very relaxed now. And that water is still moving. Give it a few more seconds, and it will get more still than I could ever hold it. And that's how we develop deep meditation. If you try and make the mind still by holding it, it will never work. You'll always be agitating the mind. Thoughts, plans, memories, tension will always come up. Jinchai, look, that's almost absolutely still. There's no way I could ever hold that water that still. That's my mind in this simile. There's no way you can hold your mind still. Every time you try, you'll always make it move. If you just leave it alone, just relax. Leave it alone, let it go, be kind, be gentle. And it gets very still all by itself. That's the way you meditate, and it goes deep. Which is why that when people learn how to let go and relax, in those very deep meditations, which sometimes people get, sometimes some of my lay disciples will get these jhanas. And I'm bored with asking this question, but the first few times I ask them, what do you do special that time that you got into this very, very deep meditation state? The reason I don't ask the question anymore is because people always give the same answer. They say, for the first time I really let go. They really let go, they stopped trying. And that answer came back so many times. I said, yeah, of course. You know why people get into deep meditation. They finally figure out they've got to let go and wait. Relax. Soothe, ease, soften, expand. Be peaceful. Stop striving, struggling, and making your body and mind so tense. It feels good for the body. Hold the body up tight. Come on, sit up straight. That feels terrible, doesn't it? Stop it. Just relax now. Doesn't it feel much better? You know, that last year, again, I always follow science because I used to be a scientist. I was told when I started meditating that you've got to have a straight back. You know, as I tell you, you put your legs together, straighten up your back. Last year, scientists, doctors came up and said, that is bad for your back. And actually, it felt it was bad. It felt so tight and tense. They said the best posture for your body is when you lean back about an angle of 20 degrees. Feels good, doesn't it? You have to have a support so you don't fall over. That's why your chairs, and most of you at the back, are leaning back about 20 degrees. You know why you're doing that? Because that is the most comfortable position of your body. And so why didn't these doctors tell me that years ago? We always think straight back is the best back, but it's not. 20 degrees back. Science tells us that's the most comfortable position. You know, I knew that, but I never believed it. I believed what my teachers said instead of what my body said. Now you understand how to relax. Feel your body. See that way I sit all over the place. It feels good. So you relax, you're at ease. Because I'm a pretty relaxed monk, that's why I'm friendly. It's true, isn't it? You know, you do see some tight monks every now and again, so stiff, and it's just so hard to talk to. And sometimes so unfriendly, and you're afraid of even asking them a question. Your body language tells you a lot about what's going on in the person's mind. When you're just relaxed, it shows you've got a relaxed mind. You're peaceful, you're happy. When you're very tight and tense, it's usually you're afraid of something. So don't be tight and tense in your body. You relax the body and the mind will relax as well. Here we go. Ajahn Brahe, no questions from upstairs. Are you still up there? Bang. Yes, you're still up there. Thank you so much. If you have any questions, please send them down. As a follow-up of your insightful CD, How to Be Successful, and a resounding success of your lecture at the HR conference in April 2007 in the UK, would you consider extending your wisdom and compassion by writing a book on how to be successful in business for the world at large along the lines of opening the door of your heart? How to be successful in business, write a business book. Gee, there's so many people who do that, don't they? Different. A business group. The trouble with writing books is that it takes such a long time, and I'm afraid of writing books. Ever since that Zen monk, I think I put this in a foreword in one of those books, when I was a young Buddhist in London, the Zen monk came along and told me, anyone who writes a book will have to spend the next 7 lifetimes as a donkey. About 3 or 4 books, I've got about 28 lifetimes as a donkey to live. No, I was only joking there, but now there are so many books already. There's so many menus, but not enough people are actually eating the food. So, you know, we've got one book is enough. Read that. And just, how many books do you need to read before you get enlightened? So he said, read the book of life, the book of your heart, the book of peace. That is the best book to read. The best music is the music of silence. And the best possession is the possession of emptiness. So these are wonderful things. So yeah, maybe one day I'll do it when I get around to it. But I'm a lazy monk, as I already mentioned. Remind me. What is it the Buddhist approach to face cultural shock, i.e. going to a new country, changing jobs, etc.? Well, I always go to new countries all the time. But you know one thing which I found, no matter what country you go to, there's people are people. That's why somebody actually, this was at that talk I gave a few days ago for the World Presence Organization, these big executives. Because, you know, I was talking about what it was like being like a monk, first of all, in Western country. And, you know, in the West, number one, people aren't afraid to ask you tough questions. And number two, they're not Buddhist, so they don't respect you anyway. They want to sort of embarrass you. And somebody asked me, what was the most embarrassing question you were ever asked? And it's very clear because I think I'd only gone to Australia maybe 1 or 2 years. And one of the local schools wanted to have a talk on Buddhism. So I went along there to this school. It was like a government school, not a good school, in a very poor area. So many of the kids were extremely naughty. And this was like a group of 14-year-olds, you know, going through adolescence, being really cheeky. And after I gave my talk, any questions, a girl stood up and said, "What's your question?" And she said, "Do girls still turn you on?" That was one of the toughest questions I ever got. But at this WPO thing, now one of these executives says, "Well, what's the answer?" And I actually told very honestly that when I see a girl or a boy now, that girl, that boy, is a container. It's just a body. So when I see a beautiful girl or an ugly girl, a guy or whatever, it's very hard for me to see the girl bit anymore. And it's the girl bit will create the lust or turn you on. When I see like a young lady, I see that's just their body on the outside. That's their container. And I know underneath there's this wonderful being. And it's exactly the same as if I look at a man or a child, whether a Muslim, Christian or whatever. Because it's your body is the container of you. And I've trained myself not to see containers, but see contents. What's inside you? What's this actually body carrying inside? When I see what it's carrying, it's this human being, you know, who's afraid, you know, who, you know, wants to find some peace, who wants to actually love and be loved, but sometimes doesn't know how to do it. Or sometimes makes mistakes. Someone who wants to be valued, who wants to find peace, but sometimes gets confused and very hurt, even damaged sometimes. So when I see that human being inside, I see that also in the cats in my monastery or the kangaroos. The kangaroo body is a container. And inside is this being who's afraid of, you know, danger, who wants to just have a bit of fun and peace, wants to sleep and not be disturbed. We actually see what's inside the container of this different forms of beings. You can have enormous compassion and kindness. So, no, girls don't turn me on. People turn me on. Beings turn me on with compassion, not with lust. And that's quite honest. Just to see a person, you feel this incredible wanting to serve and want to be of help. So it's a container. If you just stop at container, you get lust. Really, ooh, she's a very nice container. Oh, he's really hunky. Look at his muscles. But what's inside those muscles? Big, strong person. And it's just really softy inside. You know that we have these motorbike gangs, Hell's Angels, over in Australia, Coffin Cheaters, they call themselves, God's Garbage, all these names they give themselves for these motorcycle gangs. And once, I have great fun being in the West, once there was a friend of mine who was a Buddhist, her son was in one of these gangs, and no, he killed himself on his motorbike. And he wasn't a Buddhist, but his mum was. And she asked me, can you come along to give me some support? So I said, yeah, I'll come along. I wasn't supposed to do their funeral service. And when I went inside, there's all these bikies, you know, with their leathers and tattoos. And really big, mean dudes, as they say. But even worse than that, you know, they're girls. This was in the middle of, it was a funeral. And they were like dressed like they were going to nightclub. In other words, there was more flesh and there were clothes on them. You know, almost like there were nothing on at all. But the mother decided she wanted to conduct the funeral herself for her son, but she just found she just could not do it. So I was just in the back trying to give her some support, and then she just choked up. She couldn't go on, and then she said, hang on, there's a professional in here. Ajahn Brahm, help! So I just came up, and I just took over the funeral service. And these tough bikies, some of them are drug dealers, they came up afterwards, very nice service, sir. Yeah, very good service. Yeah, very lovely words you said, sir. They were just so respectful and kind and nice. And so, you know, they could beat other people up. But they always had this beautiful soft spot inside. When you saw their soft spot, oh, it was just so nice to see these people with these big macho tattoos and leather jackets. Like, look, they were really mean. But inside, they were just so soft. And that's why I never see containers anymore. They're, you know, their tattoos, you know, their fashion and their piercings and their, you know, big leather jackets saying kill the police or whatever. That was just their, you know, just doing their thing. They wouldn't kill the police. But inside, when you don't stop with the stop looking at the containers, look in the contents, oh, some wonderful things inside. That's why I never look at the outside. Look at the inside. And then there's no difference between being Chinese, being Malay, being African, being Caucasian. That's just containers. Contents, the same. That makes sense? Okay, next question here. Do you personally buy the idea on what was performed on Bob Dent by a speaker at the Fourth Global Conference on Buddhism in Perth in 2006 in the euthanasia debate? It is against the very teachings of the Buddha on karma. Thank you. The Buddha taught a lot on karma, but the Buddha also taught that karma is so complicated, so complex. I mentioned this morning. Only the Buddhas can fully understand the law of karma. Basically, it's such a difficult issue. And so, first of all, what the Bob Dent did was not talked about by the Buddha. Some of the things the Buddha said would point in that direction, but didn't go far enough to give a judgment. So basically, you can't really just look at a Buddhist text and say that was good, that was bad, that was good karma or bad karma. Just you can't do that. There's too many things in life just do not fit the texts. All the text can do is to give us some idea of how to proceed and form a wise, informed, compassionate judgment, if we have to judge at all. So that when I looked at Bob Dent's case and other cases since, euthanasia happens in Malaysia, it's just not admitted to. I don't know if there's any nurses or doctors here, but I'm sure this has happened in Malaysia, that sometimes the nurse has given that extra bit of morphine, knowing it will kill that patient, because out of compassion for that patient, what they think is compassion, they don't want to see that patient suffer. And they'll do that, and they are doing that, and doctors do that. Is that bad? Killing is supposed to be bad. But one of the cases which really made me stop and think Again, when I was visiting my mother, I was watching the TV with her to keep her company, the news, nothing sort of racy, just the news. And I was fascinated because a snippet of news came up in a hospital, I think it was in Swansea. There was a woman who had two fetuses in her womb. And it was some rare complication, but it was absolutely 100% sure that if the doctor did not intervene, then both babies would die and so would the mother. The alternative, and it was only one other alternative, was to abort one of the fetuses, to kill one of the children growing up in the womb, and then the other child and the woman would certainly survive. And it was such a clear decision. It was black and white. But because it was a moral problem, it got talked about in the news and had all these people from different religions, not Buddhist religions, all saying what you should do. And I was fascinated to hear these arguments. And unfortunately, before the debate really got interesting, the next day they found out the doctor had already made the decision and aborted one of the fetuses so the mother and the other one could live. But I ask this question of you. If you were that doctor and you had responsibility or duty of care on that woman and she had two fetuses in her womb, would you perform that abortion as a Buddhist? As a monk I can't do this, but if I was a lay doctor, I would. I had a choice between killing one or killing three. And don't think that doing nothing is not karma. If you have an opportunity to help and you do nothing and you don't do it, that is unskillful karma. Non-action is as bad as action sometimes. That's certainly in our laws of our country. If somebody is injured and you just walk past them and you don't offer any assistance, I think you could be, in certain situations, subject to breaking the law. And it's a moral outrage not to help people when they're sick or injured. Now you can see how complicated these precepts are. However, these are only in those areas, the grey areas of precepts. Most areas it's very simple. You know, you don't take alcohol, you don't go with another person's wife. Those are the simple ones. However, there's always these interesting grey areas. That's why the Buddha said only Buddhas can really understand that law of karma. So I say that this is what I would do. I thought Mr. Denton probably did the right thing, but I could be wrong. Because that's such a complex area of karma that I would actually defer to the Buddha. But if that's what you decide, then I would always support you. This is complex areas. But instead of putting all the focus on the complex areas, focus on the easy areas. Don't go around sort of killing animals or killing people like they do in the United States with all these school shootings. At least you know that's bad karma, that's quite clear. You know certainly it's bad karma to steal or to commit adultery. It's bad karma to lie. So get those very clear black and white karmas pure first of all. And those things on the edge like euthanasia, they're interesting. But the very worst case, it's only small bad karma, tiny bad karma. There's many worse things you do in life than that. That's why I don't judge people like Mr. Dent. So anyway, that's very interesting but very deep question. But when I mentioned about the abortion, I've asked that question to many people. Two kids in a womb, mother, and it was so clear, you bought one, the other two survive. Do nothing, all three die. What would you do? Most people say, if they were the doctor, that's what they would do. Makes you think more deeply. Okay, next question. Please let me know where to get an English textbook on the teachings of the 12 causal coexistence, starting with ignorance and ending with old age and death. Can Venerable share with us the importance of knowing it? And I'm fascinating with Buddhism in Malaysia because you get so much textual information. Now, you're very privileged in your knowledge of suttas and the knowledge of Buddhism and the amount of books and the courses available to you. Does it really help? Does it keep your marriages together, stop you getting angry, lower your stress levels? Well, it's important to know this because sometimes we spend so much time studying and hardly any time practicing. And it's a practicing, to put what you know into practice. It's okay knowing some theory, but the theory has to be taken with the practice. And the practice, are talking about the 12 links of dependent origination. I know these things. I recite them in Pali if you want. I wrote articles about these, the scholarly ones, but you know, sometimes that's a bit of fun and games if you're a scholar, but to actually understand it deeply, dependent origination is all about how you can get reborn, how you can have reincarnation without a soul. Because this is a question people ask. Buddhists believe in reincarnation, but there's a soul. So what gets reincarnated? How does that whole process work from life to life? What's the connection? And that's what dependent origination is supposed to teach you. And so I take all those links, you know, just push them all together and simplify it. If you want to, like we're building my Jhana Grove Meditation Retreat Center, how will you get there? You need two reasons, two causes to get to my retreat center over in Australia. Number one, you want to go there. Number two, you have the means to get there. Passport, air ticket, visa. If you have the means and you want to get there, you will get there. If you have the means, you've got the money, but you don't want to get there, you'll never get there. Or if you want to get there, but you've got no money, again, you won't get there. You have to have both, the wanting and the means. In dependent origination, the wanting to get reborn in this realm or that realm is called craving. The means is called karma. So if you want to get, say, reborn again, you know, as a human being, number one, you have to want to be a human being. And number two, you have to have the karmic causes for human rebirth. If you want to go to heaven, you have to want to go there. You have to have the karmic causes for that. And don't think that, well, everybody wants to go to heaven. Of course you don't. Sometimes you want to come back because, you know, your friends and loved ones are here. People in Australia, sometimes they're very stupid. They've told me in their next life they want to be reborn as a dog. They said that. I say, come, why do you want to be reborn as a dog? And they say, because then I don't have to go to work on a Monday morning. I can lay around and sleep all day. And the only job I have to do is let people stroke me. It's a great life as a dog, especially in Western country. You don't have to worry about anything, do you? You get food all the time, really nice food in the West. And if you're a really good dog and get a good rebirth in a rich person's house, have you seen the newspapers? You can actually inherit millions of dollars. You can be, as a dog, you can be even richer than anyone in this room. But then I tell people, look, if you get reborn as a dog, one of the first things they'll do to you is take you to the vet. And you know what happens there. And when they hear that, they say, I don't want to be a dog. I don't want to get castrated or my tubes tied up. So be careful what you want. But that's basically dependent origination. Now the craving and the karma, that's what determines your rebirth. And sometimes, how do you get reborn in hell? Who would want to get reborn in hell? Anyone who feels guilty. Any psychologist here would know that people who have powerful guilt feel they don't deserve happiness, and it's called self-harm, self-punishment. You send yourself to hell. Look at people like Britney Spears, sending herself to hell. Crazy sometimes, some people. But that's because that's where we think we belong. That's where we go. It's craving again. Craving is not always for happiness. Many people actually crave pain and punishment. It's usually guilt, lack of self-esteem. Why some young girls in the West, they cut themselves. Self-harm. People do that and send themselves to hell because that's what they think where they belong. Craving is a very complex thing. And craving and the karma go together and you can send yourself to any realm of existence. And that's what dependent origination is all about. Now when I explain it like that, you can see it makes sense. You can understand it more deeply. Which is why I'd like to explain it this way first. Understand it deep down, understand its essence first, and then read the book. And then all these terms, you get to understand how they all work together. And no longer is it scholastic, it is actually experiential. And that's what Buddhism was always meant to be. The experiential, ahipassiko, pachatang weditabo winyuhi, to be seen each wise person for themselves. To be seen in here, and then look to the books afterwards. Anyone want to comment on that? Okay, quickly. Yeah, done that one. What is a Buddhist approach to face cultural shock? Did I finish that one? You did? Okay, yeah. Okay, that's right. Seeing everybody is the same. How do we tame a rebellious mind through meditation? You don't tame your mind, you control freak. You make peace with your mind. This is a classic story. I'm sure you've heard these stories before, but in context, sometimes they hit home at last. Monastery over in northeast Thailand, where I was maybe 3 or 4 years as a monk. Many people who know the rural areas. Water buffalo were used to plow the fields, to graze. Their dung was used as fertilizer. They were so important. They were used to pull the carts. They're an important part of a person's family. And so during the dry season, people would really look after their water buffalo. They would lead them out from the village into the fields to graze. So they try a string around the neck and gently lead the water buffalo out to the fields. And water buffalo are usually very docile animals. But every now and again they get scared. And at this particular time, this man was walking his water buffalo just outside our monastery. Water buffalo got scared and started to run off. And this stupid man tried to stop the water buffalo. Which is stronger, a water buffalo or a man? And what happened was, as he was trying to stop the water buffalo, the string wound around his finger and pulled the finger off. Just the top of the finger. So this man came into our monastery with like a bit of bone sticking out and blood all over his hand. It wasn't a sort of a dangerous injury, it just looked a bit gross. But we took him to the hospital and we got him patched up and he just had one finger shorter than the other, that was all in the end. But we use that as an example for meditation. Sometimes your mind is as strong as a water buffalo. When it wants to run away, let it. Don't try and fight your water buffalo rebellious mind. If you do, it will pull many fingers off. Now what that man should have done was just let the water buffalo run away. It only runs 100, 200 meters down the road. And then it calms down, you walk after it and put it back again. The rebellious mind does not last very long as you don't feed it. You let it go. And soon it stops and you can put it in again. I told that story once there's a lady, she's one of the Singaporean Buddhist Fellowship counselors. So she came to my monastery to stay for a while. And she had the rebellious mind. She just couldn't stop her mind thinking. There's nothing else to do in the monastery except meditate. So she came to see me and said, look, I'm thinking all the time. It's driving me crazy. What should I do? I told her that story. And I also told her another story about one of the disciples in Perth who had a rebellious daughter, 6 years old. And the daughter said, "Mummy, I don't love you anymore. I want to leave home." Now this, only six. Now this mother was a very wise meditator. I really admire her sort of wisdom and understanding of human psychology. So when her six-year-old said she wanted to leave home, mother said, "Oh, that's okay, fine, I'll come and help you pack." So the two of them went into the kid's bedroom and they got a little case out and packed her with all, you know, her dolls and teddy bears and a couple of change of clothes. And said, mother said, "Wait a long, I'll make you some sandwiches first of all." So she made the favorite sandwiches for the child, and the child, sort of the mother was at the entrance of the house, at the door, and waved her child off, "Have a nice life." And the little six-year-old, carrying her sandwiches in her bag, walked out away from home. She reached the end of the street, maybe 50 meters, and by that time, the little six-year-old was already homesick. She turned around and walked right back into her mother's waiting arms. What do you expect a six-year-old to do? And when I told that story, this Singaporean girl, this Chinese girl, she was falling over, laughing, holding her tummy. She couldn't help herself. And I said, "What? This is a temple. Behave yourself." She said, I can't stop it." I said, "Why? What are you laughing for?" And she said, "The same thing happened to me when I was five or six. Over in Singapore, in one of the big HDB flats, she had an argument with her mother, and she said, 'I'm leaving home.' And her mother, I don't know who the mother is, but again, she's a very smart girl, said, 'Okay, darling,' helped her pack, but in Singapore, she didn't have time to make sandwiches. She gave her $20 for her lunch." So their little kid with a bag and $20 went to the elevator, the lift, and sort of went down. And as the doors closed, the mother waved her off. And of course, she got to the bottom, to ground floor, and by that time, she was homesick. So pressed the floor where she lived. And her mother was actually waiting for her. When the lift opened, sort of they hugged and kissed again. Now, isn't that beautiful psychology? The child won't go far. And a 5 or 6 year old, if you let it go, it comes back very quickly. And that's exactly what you do with the mind. 16 year old, well, 6, they're going to go anyway. Bye bye, have a nice life, but don't give them $20, they won't last 5 minutes. But for that, it was great psychology. And that's exactly how you use your mind as well. If your mind is rebellious, wants to run off, pack its bags, give it $20 and say, "Have a nice time, mine. I'm fed up with you anyway." And then it only goes so far, it comes back in, because you're relaxing. Why do people want to run away anyway? Why are you rebellious? Because no one's being kind to you. If you're kind to your mind is kind to you. Give a little bit of loving kindness and the mind wants to stay with you. That's how it works. So that's how you tame the mind. With wisdom, with compassion, you don't tame a rebellious mind through willpower. If you try willpower, you just get more stuffed up. Oh, this is interesting. Look at this question. People will really wake up. Recently, there was this sex scandal in Hong Kong. You interested? Human nature, they love scandals, especially sex scandals. And some obscene photos being circulated on the internet. Is this wrong to view these photos? How do you know? I'm going to check the writing on this. Have you got the registration form so I can compare? So find. That's an actually interesting question, isn't it? Is that going against the precepts? It's certainly unskillful in the sense of, you know, why do you want to watch those obscene photos for? You know, just it maybe gives you a moment of pleasure, maybe, but not really nice pleasure. So what do you want to do it for anyway? So is it wrong? I wouldn't say right or wrong. I'd say it's just unwise. What are you doing it for? Haven't you got anything better to do with your life? (Laughs) People say they're so busy. How come you have time to watch that sort of stuff? There's a certain amount of pleasure in doing something which is wrong. Just being naughty, that's all. You get a bit sort of excited, you know, just doing something which is a bit sort of unallowed. But then afterwards, you should grow up out of that and say, yeah, and the reason it's not allowed, the reason it's called obscene, it's a scandal, there must be some reason for it. You know, and the reason is, you know, it's just inciting some emotions and some feelings inside of you, which may lead to other, even more worse things. I don't know if it's been proved yet, but people often say just, you know, the violence on the internet, the pornography on the internet, leads, you know, to more sexual crimes in the community. And there might be that as well. There might be that. I don't mean to like to be a prude, but, you know, as long as it's not going to have a deleterious effect on people's behavior, I can't see anything wrong with it. But if it's really going to harm, make people more violent, maybe increase rapes or sexual exploitation, I don't think that's a good thing to do. So I don't know what the obscene photos are. I haven't looked at them. But if it's really creating problems and difficulties, then give it up, stop doing it. Instead, you know, I'm on YouTube. You can watch monks on YouTube instead of, you know, porn on YouTube. Dharma is much more powerful than obscene. So that's a really weird question. And I promise, actually, I will not compare your handwriting and find out who it is. You are completely safe. So these are ways. Any other questions before we finish off for tea? It's supposed to be at 2:45 for a tea break. Yeah, last, yes? Daily meditation schedule. It's uncertain, always changes, never one day the same. Basically, because, you know, I have to adapt to all sorts of different things. Because, you know, when you're a boss, you know, like you're the clearing house, and so if anything goes wrong, I have to fix it, or at least talk to people. So my meditation is basically being in the moment. And if there's someone in front of me, then I will care for you and give all my attention to you. If no one is in front of me, I'll close my eyes and just be still and peaceful. That's my meditation. And I always make sure that every year, usually in these days in August or no, September, I'd usually spend 2 months in my cave and I don't come out. 2 weeks, sorry. It'd be great if it was 2 months, that must be wishful thinking. And that time I'd tell all the other monks and lay people around, I don't care what happens. And if all you monks fall in love or go and watch obscene pictures on the internet, it's none of my business, do what you want, don't bother me for 2 weeks. So that's actually what I do. For 2 weeks, then I just stay in my hut and just meditate all day. And most of the night as well. That's my sort of little time off. And I don't need to go to a holiday camp or a resort. My resort's inside. So I just close the door and just go inside. So that's actually my life. I like teaching meditation retreats simply because that's a time when everyone else is meditating and I'm meditating as well. So I also get some much more time for meditation when I teach retreats. When you come to like Malaysia this time, I give myself completely to you guys. To teach, 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 talk as much as you want. But they don't have to worry because when I go back, I'm much quieter. So I don't have a schedule. Much nicer that way, because you don't have to think, oh, I've got to get up this morning. Oh, I've missed my meditation. That's not fair. No, just keep it smooth, keep it loose. And there's plenty of time to meditate. Does that make sense? Okay, it's 2:45. So now is tea meditation, where you can all have some vitamin C, vitamin caffeine. if you want to wake up. So I think there's things to eat as well. It's only supposed to be a 15-minute break, but I can't see that finishing eating in 15 minutes. When we had lunch upstairs, and I started my lunch, what is it, 11:30. I was finished by about 10 to 12. And then afterwards, I invited everybody else to have their lunch. And they started about 12. They were still in there about 1:05. So I can't see how you're going to finish in 15 minutes, but give it a try anyway. So have some tea, have a bit of something to eat, and we'll come back when we're ready. So maybe about 3 o'clock, maybe 3:15, see what happens. So relax to the max and have a nice cup of tea or something to eat, okay? And upstairs as well, hopefully you got some more heavenly food up there and even more delicious tea than we have. Thank you very much for banging your feet again, but not too hard, otherwise the floor will come in. Okay. Very good.